Welcome to History 101, Lecture 20, Nationalisms. To take up the line of the previous lecture, for a long time it used to be argued that slavery had become by 1830 a marginally profitable institution, as the capitalists had now found a cheaper source of labor to exploit than black labor on plantations, white labor in factories. As such, Carolina or Virginia planters, as Jefferson and Washington, who sat at the peak of America's economic order in the 18th century, were displaced by a new industrial bourgeoisie, they, as it were, retreated into a kind of archaic, feudal world of their own invention. The con with the wind south. It then further used to be argued that in the US South, the planters clung to their plantations and to their slaves because they feared both the industrial bourgeoisie and the industrial proletariat of the North, although the peculiar institution was only marginally profitable. This view was savaged in 1975 by a famous book of Stanley Engerman and Robert Fogel, Time on the Cross, a book that was at the time paraded as the exemplar of a new, truly scientific history, cliometrics, that had as large claims at the time as big history often has nowadays. Subsequent research has somewhat dimmed Engerman's and Fogel's vast claims. Much of the contemporary figures they used to erect a vast mathematical edifice on were at best guesswork. Yet what the two did clearly prove, and one claim that has withstood all subsequent criticism, is that at the times of the outbreak of the Civil War, slavery was still highly profitable, and that plantations were an equally good, if not better, investment than factory. That stifled industry in the south of the US, where the little industry there was remained largely linked to plantations. Due to the innate dynamics of capitalism, the USA thus split in the 19th century in two, and in reality three, and probably even four economies. First, there was the South, an economy fostered on plantations with the surrounding agriculture to feed those plantations, that produced cotton for export to Britain. The South, therefore, was a proponent of free trade and low tariffs to foster exports of cotton, and it had a black slave and a locally born white labor force. A white labor force who were often poorer than the slaves, worse fed, and sometimes even worse treated. So that practically the only thing those rednecks could fall back on to affirm their human dignity was the color of their skin. And hence, this was also a commonly ferociously racist group, as they have indeed remained unto the present. And on the other hand, there was the industrializing North, with a by and large white population consisting of immigrants, which wanted high tariff walls to protect its nascent industries and government subsidies to the industries. And the northern states all began to abolish slavery while it boomed in the south, so that the US Congress in 1820 settled on a compromise that slavery was to be prohibited above the 36th parallel northern latitude. Aside from this, the new agricultural states of the Midwest and the territory that was annexed from Mexico in 1847, or the Wild West, that produced grain and obviously cows, herded by cowboys for the world market. The Wild West supported the southern states in pleading for low tariffs and free trade. Yet on the other hand, it wanted government subsidies to keep the price of land as low as possible. And finally, there was yet a fourth group, primarily dependent on mining. California, Arizona, and Nevada, where agriculture really only developed to feed the miners. It were, incidentally, fact rarely mentioned about the Civil War. The vast silver reserves in Nevada, discovered at the very eve of the Civil War, the Comstock Lode, that underpinned the finances of the Union during the Civil War, and that negated the effects of the cessation of cotton exports on the finances of the central government, on which the South had counted. Had it not been for the Comstock Lode, the Union could not have afforded the almost unlimited resources it threw at the Civil War. While the economy of the Union was booming during the Civil War, which made the war somewhat palpable even for recent immigrants. Now the view of Engerman and Vogel can well be extended to cover more areas than merely the USA. Until the 1870s and even the 1880s, slave plantations remained profitable. And not merely in the USA, but in Brazil as well. Brazil thus got stuck with several economies as well. In the Brazilian case, there was the Northwest, built around slave-run plantations, with a predominantly black population and dominated by an oligarchy of planters, exactly like the USA South. There were Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, with a mainly immigrant population, and that featured the early beginnings of industrialization in the 1880s, as the first textile mills using immigrant labor were established there, and where the plantation slaves were gradually replaced by immigrant workers. Then there were the mines of Minas Gerais, which in the 19th century still produced gold and diamonds, to which the first iron works were added in the early 19th century. And finally, there was the cattle-producing Brazilian South, that as the opportunities for capturing Indian laborers in neighboring Paraguay somewhat decreased in the 19th century, began to rely increasingly on white immigrants. The region attracted large numbers of German immigrants after 1818 that were settled in places they called Novo Hamburgo, Nova Harz or Leoniterhof, nowadays all suburbs of the southern capital of Porto Alegre. That region, in contrast, had few or no slaves. Now, admittedly, the Brazilian Empire and Republic, after 1889, had its share of regional separatist movements too. Yet only in the United States, both the issue of slavery and the increasing regional divergence brought about by commercial mining and agriculture led to an all-out civil war between one half of the country and the other. For while in Brazilian politics too, by the 1850s, the issue of slavery had become the single most divisive issue in politics, this rather led to divisions within the Brazilian elites between conservative slaveholding elites and liberal abolitionists all over the country, rather than to the regional split that occurred in the USA. For whereas slaves were rare in Rio Grande do Sul, slaves were, on the one hand, more equally spread across Brazil than was the case in the USA. The main slaveholding states were Bahia and Rio de Janeiro. And on the other hand, Brazil lacked, until the 1880s, any industry that could even compare with New York's or New England's. And there was in Brazil, unlike in the USA, thus no strong lobby for a policy of providing incentives to industry by way of tariffs. In treatments of the Civil War, it is often argued that the war was either about slavery, or about tariffs, or about the constitutional issue of state versus union rights. But in reality, it was about all three. To the average Union soldier, while he might hold the niggers in deep contempt, and surely did not care for tariffs, he was fighting rebels against the Union. The war was until the 1880s therefore officially known as the War of the Rebellion, until the politics of reconstructing the South was quietly shelved in the early 80s, and it became known as the Civil War instead. A war of brother against brother, where both sides were now fighting for an equally noble cause. To the Confederate soldiers, very few of whom owned slaves, and in fact big slave owners often managed to dodge a war largely fought out by poor whites. That war was not about slavery, but it was about the right of states to decide on their own affairs without any dictation by the Union government. And it was too, more broadly, to defend the Southern way of life. It was a combination of three factors. The divisive issue of slavery in a country that deemed itself the land of the free, unlike the Brazilian monarchy, which was rather patterned on European constitutional monarchies, such as France and Belgium after 1830, Sweden or the Netherlands after 1848, then the regional divergence of the USA in a plantation, an industrial and an agricultural region, unlike in Brazil, where plantations were both found in relatively backward Maranhão, as in Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo, and the USA's federal constitution, unlike the, in principle, more centralized Brazilian empire, though the first Brazilian republic replaced the empire with a federal constitution, in which Brazil was henceforth to be known as the United States of Brazil, those three factors together explain the Civil War. Yet they do not explain its singular bitterness. For what is perhaps most striking is that even in 1864, as it was clear to everybody, including the Southerners, that the war had long been lost, the Confederate Army just went on fighting until practically the entire South lay in ashes. The white Confederate soldiers fought on to forestall their enslavement by the North. Rather than submit to Northern slavery, I prefer death, as one slaveholding officer in the Confederate Army wrote. Or they fought on to defend their homes against Vandal enemies, as they put it. We are fighting for our firesides and property, they would say. After the war, Confederate General Robert E. Lee wrote, quote, that he objected to the phrase, too often used, South as well as North, that the Confederates fought for what they thought was right. They fought for what they knew was right. They, like the Greeks, fought for home, graves of their sires, and their native land, as indeed not merely the ancient Greeks did, but the modern Greeks in 1821 as well. In other words, the Southerners were driven by Southern nationalism. For 19th century nationalism, as it developed after the French Revolution, that was indeed a fulcrum from which it diffused from Europe to Latin America and the West, to the Ottoman Empire in the East, and by the 60s to Asia, and to the Afrikaners in South Africa, and a few African intellectuals in such places as Freetown, Sierra Leone, and Cape Coast in Ghana besides, was at once a centripetal and a centrifugal force. Its two great success stories were its centripetal moments, the two great national unifications, that of Italy under the twin leadership of two larger-than-life figures, the quintessential, wily, scheming politician Camillo Cafur, Prime Minister of Sardinia Piemont, and that quintessential hero of the 19th century, Giuseppe Garibaldi, doubtlessly the greatest star of the century, who then had a similar status as that other quintessential, romantic, selfless hero, great example for the youth, Ernesto Che Guevara, for a while had in the 60s beyond Latin America, and that he still has in Latin America. And there was the greatest geopolitical upheaval of the 19th century, the German unification under Otto von Bismarck, of which only two decisive aspects need to be underlined at this point. First, that it was achieved by blood and iron by the Prussian army, rather than by a bunch of wishy-washy liberal professors or lawyers assembled in the Frankfurt Parliament in 1848 who had first tried to achieve it. And this gave the German army, or really the Prussian army, unrivaled prestige in the new German state, and it was to bequeath a poisoned legacy of militarism to Germany in the late 19th and 20th century. The German Empire was a state where Nobel Prize-winning scientists, captains of industry with billions in the bank, would still pride themselves on being reserve officer in the army. And second, the state that emerged was the Kleindeutsch state. It was exclusively German and excluded both the German-speaking Austrians and such German-speaking enclaves in the Austrian Empire as the Sudetenland on the border between Germany and the Czech-speaking lands. Though that German-speaking national state admittedly still included 4 million Poles, who were at best rated second-rate citizens of the German Empire. Yet, as Karl Marx said, so long as we Germans keep part of Poland fettered to Germany, we shall be unable to smash patriarchic absolutism at home. The creation of a democratic Poland is the primary perquisite for a democratic Germany. Less successfully, unification movements also included various PAN movements in Eastern Europe that wanted to unite various people speaking various cognate languages that were now part of different states and empires into a single national state, or at least into a single autonomous region. There were, for example, the Pan-Czechs that wanted to unite with the Slovaks in a single state that was to be called Czechoslovakia. There were the Pan-Hellenists who wanted Macedonia, Aegean islands under Ottoman, later on Italian rule, and Cyprus to become part of a greater Greece, while the more extreme elements pleaded for the annexation of Constantinople besides. Then there were the Pan-Rumenianists, and most faithfully, as it was of course the direct cause of World War I, there was a Pan-South Slavonic movement that wanted to unify all South Slavonic-speaking people in a single state that was from the 1890s on to be called Yugoslavia. Yet nationalism was centripetal too. It featured equally many attempts of national minorities or nations that, when they had become incorporated into empires and thus had become national minorities, such as the Poles, to split off from those empires, or from half-hearted attempts to forge new national states out of disparate areas, such as the successful secession of the Southern Netherlands in 1830 from a united Kingdom of the Netherlands, to establish a new state, guaranteed as an independent state, provided it stayed neutral, by the Great Powers in 1831 under the name of Belgium. Or again, there was the unsuccessful attempt of the part of Poland under Russian rule, so far a semi-independent viceroyalty of the Russian Empire, called Congress Poland, to secede from Russia in 1830. That attempt was bloodily suppressed by Russian troops a few months later, and that led, on the one hand, to the definitive incorporation of Poland into Russia, and on the other, to a flood of refugees to Europe and to the United States, including national poet Mickiewicz and national composer Frédéric Franciszek Chopin. As this Polish uprising and attempted secession from Russia was universally acclaimed in the United States, and as the leader of the Hungarian secession movement, Lajos Kossuth, was bestowed a hero's welcome in the USA, the Southerners might well feel that if Poland or Hungary were apparently permitted to secede in the cause of liberty, why could the South not do so too? For if we perceive the Civil War as part of America's singular, immortal struggle and of its forward march to liberty, commonly presented in U.S. education, it is indeed a unique event in world history. Yet if we rather see it as a rebellion, an armed secession by states from a union of states, as the majority states try to impose unpopular measures on the minority, then it stands throughout in the companionship of the Polish or Belgian uprising. In the USA, there was on the one hand an all-American nationalism associated with the veneration of the American dream, the idea of America as a city on a hill, separated from all evils of the world, and the veneration of the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, the patriotism that was and is imbued or drilled into any American by secondary and higher education. American patriotism was an exclusive nationalism, the kind of nationalism that could easily be absorbed by, say, Yiddish-speaking immigrants from Lithuania within a couple of years, while most other forms of nationalism, such as that of Lithuania, are exclusive. They stress the ancient ties to the native soil and to the native tongue, and in fact, they commonly exclude Jews from the national community. Such exclusive nationalism was a kind of nationalism not fit to a nation of immigrants. And there was too, even long after the Civil War, the subdued current of exclusive Southern nationalism, a nationalism that has slowly withered in the 20th century. Slowly. For the North-South divide is still the most persistent and the most fundamental factor in American politics. As Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, the South always voted Democratic until the Civil Rights era, the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, who Southerners, as Lyndon Johnson was both a Democrat and very much a Southerner, rated as a traitor. They then shifted en bloc to the Republicans, and the South has continued to vote Republican ever since, no matter what the rest of the country does. So too, experiments in social psychology amongst university students still tend to indicate that there are very clear differences in behavior amongst white male students from the South and Yankee students. The Southerners are wedded to a code of honor that is very different from Yankee views. Indeed, incomprehensible to the Yankees. 150 years after the Civil War, there is, in other words, still a what in other contexts might be called national character of the South. A national character that makes it quite distinctive from the North. And all this despite recent mass migrations of Yankees to the South. So that, meanwhile, Southerners are a minority in the South. To state it very bluntly, but why should the US be very different from any other country? On this moment, Southern nationalism has been muted by the economic development in the USA after the 60s. This has led to the rise of the Southern Sun Belt, while the cold industrialized Yankee North increasingly turned into a rust belt. So in this moment, the South has very clear material incentives staying with the USA. Yet, were such developments to be reversed, a revival of Southern separatism is not only conceivable, but likely. We should not assume the USA is immune to forces that have torn Austria-Hungary or Yugoslavia apart. For, and this will surely be clearer to European, or for that matter African listeners, than to American ones, states have all and always at best a provisional existence. There have been no changes in the number of states in the Americas since the former captaincy of Guatemala disintegrated in 1841 into the states of Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. Yet European, Asian, and African states have been coming and going, and that all too often completely unexpectedly for their subjects. For example, however much we are now easily able, with benefit of hindsight, to discern it was a tottering, weak, and on the point of dying structure, nobody in reality would or could in 1914 have predicted the coming demise of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. In 1907, Austrian socialist Otto Bauer could write that the empire in the coming 20 years would gradually devolve towards a federation like the United States. But he thought it completely obvious it would exist in 20 years' time. Robert Musil's novel Der Mann ohne Eigenschaften takes place in Vienna in May 1914. It follows the proceedings of a committee established to prepare the celebrations of the 70th jubilee of the crown of Emperor Franz Josef to take place in 1918. By these festivities, they are to extol the supreme virtues of the Austro-Hungarian state, and above all, its furtherance of the cause of peace and global disarmament. So the worthy delegates are pondering whether to call the year 1918 the Austrian Peace Year or call for World Peace Year altogether immediately. For much like Southern nationalism in the USA is loyalty to one's native land and people as against the attachment to the USA that is built on an idea, the American dream, so too loyalty to Austria-Hungary was the attachment to an idea of the monarchy that symbolized centuries of stability and mostly peaceful coexistence of nationalities in Central Europe, and indeed in Europe, as against the narrow blood-and-soil romanticisms of local nationalisms. Such local nationalisms would merely be a brief for chaos and instability in Central Europe, and indeed in Europe, proponents of the monarchy argued, and in hindsight, with justification. The Habsburg monarchy went back for 700 years, and its tradition of Kaiserstreue several centuries as well, longer than the various local nationalisms. It can be dated all the way back 1618, and nobody could in 1914 have predicted which of the two was to prevail. Local nationalism and egoism, or loyalty to a time-hallowed monarchy, however crusty, may appear in retrospect. Though admittedly, in Austria, one often has the idea it is still ruled by our beloved emperor, Franz Josef, or by his even more beloved wife, Elisabeth von Bayern, Sissi, tragically murdered in 1898 by a deranged nationalist, as any Austrian will immediately tell you. So the nation is, as the French thinker Ernest Renan put it, a plebiscite. A nation is a clearly expressed desire to continue a common life. And if that vanishes, the nation vanishes into history again. So too the modern nation-state is a plebiscite. In a nation-state, the territory of a state is ideally exactly congruent with a language, a common set of habits or a national character, a common religion, a shared history, and that kind of strong feelings of national bondage that are expressed by supporters for a national team in football matches for the Euro or the World Cup. This ideal of the nation-state has proven to be one of the most successful European cultural exports ever, after Christianity and communism. All states nowadays behave, or at least they try to behave, as if they are nation-states. Indeed, special experts in nation building now try to export it globally, from say England or the USA to Afghanistan or Moldova. Indeed, they try to impose that idea globally, as if a nation state is something you can learn from a political science textbook, much as you can be taught swimming or driving, or as many economists suppose, you can be taught the market. Yet actually, only three states historically and entirely satisfied all these conditions for a nation state, and one nowadays consists of two countries, namely Portugal, Japan and Korea. Modern nation state 4, Iceland, only separated from Denmark in 1918, whereas modern nation state 5, Poland, arose as a result of some of the most tragic events of the 20th century, the Holocaust for example, in which all its minorities were removed or wiped out. England can surely be seen as a nation state too, and English historians never tire of pointing out, even as a precocious nation state. Yet the United Kingdom, of which it is part, is not a nation state. Much of the history of Scotland can be reconstructed round its perpetual antagonism to England, while Wales had better historic ties to England, but has managed to preserve its separate language and separate identity for 1,000 years. I already talked about France. So there are virtually no ideal nation states, and the nation is a highly artificial construct. It is, as anthropologist Benedict Anderson classically called it, an imagined community. A community where one experiences a special bonding with a group of people with whom one shares a certain territory and whom one otherwise does not know at all, and from whom one might differ in sex, in color of the skin, in religion, and above all in class. The nation is in all these respects equally fake as the church with a capital letter, where too a Roman Catholic shares a common bond with other people who may live thousands of miles away, but is supposedly completely separated from a Protestant next door. And those two, indeed, share a lot, as the nation is constructed along the lines of the church. And nationalism is indeed, to some extent, a secularized religion, as the Afrikaner poet Nicolaas van Wyk Lau put it. A religion that urges us to devote our life to the greater good of the community, as he put it, much as Christians are to devote their lives to Jesus Christ. Nationalism has assumed the rituals as well. The anonymous martyrs of the church are replaced by the cult of the unknown soldier, or in many countries, national heroes enshrined in the national pantheon, or for that matter in Westminster Abbey. The hymns of the church are in nationalism replaced by the national anthem and stirring national songs, such as America the Beautiful, the Radetzky March, Wiens Nederlands Bloed door den Aderen stroomt, or Preußen's Gloria, with all the unavoidable accompanying shedding of tears. While the prayer for our father is replaced by the Pledge of Allegiance to the Nation, and the churches are replaced by pompous monuments to the nation, such as the Germania monument above the little town of Rüdesheim am Rhein, the picture of this nature. Yet nationalism is at best an incomplete stand-in for organized religion, Catholicism, or particularly for Islam, or for the comprehensive ideologies as they developed in the 19th century, as it provides no clear guideline on how the believers in nationalism are to lead their daily life, or on how they are to arrange their economy. Nationalism is, as the great socialist leader Rosa Luxemburg put it, an empty vessel in which states and classes can pour whatever they like. Nationalism has no clear position on abortion, on gay rights, or on same-sex marriages. What more have you? And while it has often been argued that the policy of high tariffs and development of industries by the aid of the state is a form of nationalist economics, in the course of the 19th century, as the British government adopted free trade in the 30s, it became, by the late 19th century, a near sacrosanct issue in British politics. So much so that it can well be said to have become an important component of British nationalism. And nationalism does not offer very clear guidelines on the politics one is to pursue either. Now, it is no doubt true that nationalism, as the great historian Eric Hobsbawm argues, gradually passed from something from the left of the political spectrum in the early 19th century to something for the broad middle in the mid-19th century, when everybody could cheer freedom and democracy, to something that moved increasingly to the right in the late 19th century. A new word was invented for this in the late 19th century, namely chauvinism, although in the USA that is mostly used as in the term male chauvinism in a very different meaning than the exaggerated bellicose nationalism it meant in the original French, and that was in France linked to the opposition to the French Third Republic. Hobsbawm's main point is undeniable. Modern German or modern Italian nationalism undeniably originated amongst radical students who were born immediately after the age of the French Revolution and harked not merely back to the glory days of the Revolution, but the post that stifling dynastic order that was imposed on Europe after 1815. And the greatest theorist of nationalism in mid-19th century Europe, Giuseppe Mazzini, was still very much a man on the left. He thought that Europe was now fixed by two great questions. The workerman's question, as it was then called, and the national question. And that solving the national question would be key to solving the workerman's question as well. For he argued, quote, "The men who plead the cause of the nationalities well know that revolutions, necessarily supported by the masses, ought to satisfy their legitimate wants. They know that a revolution is sacred whenever it has for its object the progress of millions, but that it is an unpardonable crime when it has merely for its object the interest of a minority, of a caste, or of a monopoly. They know that the problem now to be resolved is the association of all faculties and all forces of humanity towards a common end, and that such a movement cannot be simply political, but has to address the workerman's question as well." The Italian state did eventually solve Mazzini's nationality problem, the division of Italy in small states and the occupation of its northern half by Austria. However, it very much did so to further the interest of a minority, the northern bourgeoisie, and of a monopoly, the great industry of Turin or Milan. Yet by 1900, nationalism increasingly moved towards the right, and even towards the extreme right, partly as the ultra-right now claimed to be combating socialist internationalists who scorned the fatherland, and increasingly too as the extreme right claimed to stand firm against the global conspiracy of the Jews to take over the world. For anti-Semitism was very closely linked to that ultra-right nationalism. such as was, for example, the case for the right-wing nationalist ultras in Russia, the Black Hundred, who not only murdered socialists or cosmopolitan intellectuals, both terms of abuse in those circles, by the dozens, and played a major role in the infamous pogroms, but also produced the archetypical anti-Semitic text of the 20th century, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, one of the few texts on the internet you are incidentally not permitted to access in the Netherlands. Yet it was partly related to the increasing militarization of European societies, as the army, which politically always stood to the extreme right, now lay exclusive claim to embody the patriotic virtues, as against both cosmopolitans and intellectuals. Yet, if Hobsbawm is no doubt right, such nationalist movements as the Irish Fenians really included a gamut of views, ranging from the ultra-clericalists, who wanted to have Ireland after independence to be ruled by the Pope, to socialists. It is risky to assign Irish nationalism to any fixed place on the political spectrum, while similarly the various Polish national groups ran the gamut from ultra-cleric and ultra-reactionary to socialists and anarchists, and might even be united in a single person, the later Polish extreme-right dictator Józef Piłsudski, who started as a socialist and founded the Socialist Party of Lithuania. Yet after World War I, as he assumed dictatorial power in Poland, he declared that, quote, socialism had for him been merely the bus to national independence, but he had cut off at that stop. In fact, that it was a gamut of movements and views running from the extreme right to the extreme left was one reason why Marx or Friedrich Engels were by no means unqualified supporters of Polish and Irish nationalism. As I argued already, both the nation and its secular religion of nationalism developed in the 16th and 17th centuries, as the organic unity of medieval Christianity was torn apart by the Reformation, and as the states in Western Europe featured a drive to the increasing standardization of the populations, who had to become both subjects and citizens, and break the exemptions from the law enjoyed by regions or estates, all that culminated in the ideas of the French Revolution, liberté, égalité and fraternité, as I discussed before. In many ways, the main obstacle to such a national consolidation and unification is the Church, as it urges believers to put Christ above the fatherland. Yet, as we saw already with the case of Catholicism in Poland, the Church could also serve as vehicle for constructing a nation. When Poland was declared to be hereby dissolved and was decreed never to have existed, it was the Catholic Church that continued to glue Poles together, in opposition to the Orthodox Russians and to the Protestant Prussians, but even in opposition to the Catholic State Church of Austria. The other classic case of the Church shaping a nation is Ireland, where the issue has really not been solved until the present. In the 19th century, being Irish meant being a Catholic, and modern Irish nationalism originated with the struggle for Catholic emancipation in the United Kingdom in the early 19th century. Yet with the repeal of legal discrimination of Catholics in the 1830s, and of course surely after the creation of the Irish Free State in 1920, the Irish faced a problem with the Protestants, a problem that has never been solved since. For if Irish identity was exclusively defined by or constructed around the Catholic religion, what was one to do with Protestants? Obviously, a lot of them were emigres from Scotland, who could thus be branded foreigners. But some were converted Irishmen as well. So, Irish nationalists on the one hand tried to reconstruct Irish identity around the Gaelic language, admittedly spoken by less than 10% of the population, rather than by religion. And on the other, they tried to stress the common historic identity the Irish people all shared. Yet the problem was that since the whole modern period of Irish history revolves around Protestant-Catholic quarrels, they had then either to go back into the very distant past, all the way to Ireland's great age in the 6th century, or to the very recent past, to 1916, since the leaders of the Eastern Rebellion or the Revolution in Dublin saw themselves as anti-imperialist freedom fighters rather than as Catholic bigots. Yet such cases of the Church over time becoming identified with the national cause are somewhat of an exception. For most churches, and indeed most what we call world religions, were transnational organizations that transgressed or bridged national boundaries, as is perhaps best expressed in the term for the current within Catholicism in Germany and the Netherlands that stressed papal authority and condemned Catholic children going to state schools that was commonly called Ultramontanism, or from across the Alps. To be sure, some churches were only too happy to be enlisted in the national cause, as they had always been closely linked to government. Most notably, the English Anglican Church was, where the king is of course the defender of the faith. And though the Church of England became in the 19th century, during the great wave of missionary expansion with which I shall deal later, for the first time a truly global church rather than merely an English one, it always continued to be closely linked to both monarchy and to the Whig or Conservative Party. Even in the 20th century, the Anglican Church was often called the Conservative Party at prayer. Similarly, the Russian Greek Orthodox Church was always the trusty ally of Tsarist rule. Every prayer in that church began with one for the health of the Tsar. And its infamous secret police, the Okhrana, saw regular attendance in Orthodox churches as an indicator of political reliability and fear of God as a signifier somebody would fulfill his obligations to Tsar and Fatherland. Though, in a way, the Orthodox Church paid for all that state support by the utter emasculation of the political role it still had had in the 17th century. During the time of troubles, Filaret Romanov, Orthodox Patriarch, had acted as kingmaker, catapulting his son Mikhail to new Tsar. But Peter the Great had put a stop to all that, subjecting the Orthodox Church to a rigorous state-imposed hierarchy in which its clerics became little more than paid officials. However, the position of other churches, and for that matter various schools of Islam, was vastly more complicated. For both the Catholic Church, for which the believer has in the first place to have allegiance to the worldwide church and only secondarily to the state, and the Islamic concept of Ummah, the worldwide community of the faithful, conflicted with the urge of the nation states of the 19th and indeed the 20th century to split up believers into various national containers. The believers were in the first place to obey the state and only secondarily the church, and allegiance to the state was always to override that to the church, for the prime value propagated by the national states was patriotism, my country, right or wrong. Whether that country's government was condoned by the church or not. Now, in Arab Islam, that really only became a big issue with the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire and the official dissolution of the Caliphate by the new Turkish Republic in 1921, as the territories of the Ottoman Empire were now divided into various countries that in turn all patterned themselves on the modern European state. In fact, they were told to do so, as the British and French interim administration tried to teach the Arabs good governance and nation building, as they would call it nowadays, along the lines of the French Revolution, with its entire church-state separation. And those new states then all tried to enlist the Islamic scholars as supporters or even as paid servants of states that patterned themselves on the European pattern of church-state separation and patriotism, unlike in the Ottoman Empire, where the Ottoman Sultan was at once Khalif and ruler over the faithful. Whence, in the one Arabic state, with the mainstream Hanafi interpretation of the law, that still has this old pattern, namely Morocco, ruled by a Sharif, or direct descendant of Mohammed, there are far less problems with the clergy than is the case elsewhere. However, the conflict between nation and church in the 19th century already became a major issue for Muslim communities on the Balkan that were basically offered three choices. First, they might identify primarily with their religion, as happened with the Serbian Muslims, mostly concentrated in Bosnia-Herzegovina, who in the late 19th century began to reconstruct themselves under Austrian rule after 1878 as a new nationality, Bosnians or Bosniaks, where their nationality was henceforth defined by their religion, as Bosnians are of course speakers of Serb-Croats. They could also try to construct a national identity that transcended the religion, as occurred with the Albanians, who, as it were, just happened to be largely Muslim, but whose state, later on, rather harked back to the Orthodox leader of a revolt against the Ottomans in the 15th century, Skanderbeg. Albanian identity, both in Albania itself and in neighboring Kosovo, was primarily constructed around the very distinctive Albanian language, rather than the Islamic religion. Finally, in the Turkish case, religion was admittedly central to Turkish identity, but Turkish identity was equally well constructed around the Turkish language and the historic origins of the Turks in the steppes. While merely noting in passing that the reactions of the third worldwide religious hierarchy, the Buddhist, to the imposition of a secular colonial state were a bit mixed. In Ceylon, Sri Lanka, they generally acquiesced in it, while in Burma they violently resisted it. The other opponent of the imposition of the national state was the Catholic Church. For, as Pope Pius IX said in his Syllabus of Errors, the Roman pontiff can and never ought to associate himself and to reach agreement with progress, liberalism, or modern civilization. Now, there is in the history of the Catholic Church in the 19th century in some way a profound paradox, in that the Vatican in the 19th century became far more powerful and the Church far more rigorously centralized than was the case previously, and that very much with the connivance of, and commonly with the active collaboration of, the state. For in the 19th century, by a group of conquerors, starting with the conqueror with Napoleon in 1801, the Catholic Church succeeded in abolishing the various national churches in which bishops were named by the king, instead of by the pope, that had existed in Austria, in Spain, in Portugal or in France before. And the Vatican increasingly strengthened its control over the church's hierarchy as well, particularly during the long papacy of Pius IX from 1846 to 1871. This culminated in the doctrine of so-called papal infallibility, decreed by the First Vatican Council of 1869, in which henceforth any pronouncement of the Pope ex cathedra cannot be wrong. British Prime Minister William Gladstone commented with some justification that with papal infallibility, the Pope assumed a degree of authority no despotic Asian monarch would ever have dreamt of. And yet, simultaneously, the Catholic Church was becoming weaker than before too, and yielded to the national state, and it indeed constantly bewailed this as resulting from the present horrible combined age of revolution and unbelief, in which, as the Pope said, ecclesiastical power ought not to exercise its authority without permission and assent of civil government, a view that is officially condemned by the Church. Verbally, the Catholic Church thus retreated to a position of bewailing the passing of the waning. Verbally, the Catholic Church retreated to a position of bewailing the passing of the Ancien Régime, if not the waning of the close organic unity of church and state it argued had existed in the Middle Ages. Although in the real Middle Ages, rulers had in fact habitually scorned and scoffed the church, as I said before. Nonetheless, the Catholic Church was certainly right in that in the 19th century, states throughout erected ever higher barriers to the church encroaching upon their jurisdiction. Something like the case of the Cardinal Infante, that I dealt with before, became indeed unimaginable in the 19th century. Nobody could henceforth imagine a cardinal becoming, say, president of Italy, nor, as was still quite common in the 18th century, when the administration of commercial organizations and merchant companies was, in Catholic countries, studded with men of the church, an abbot becoming president of, say, Fiat. The only major European commercial organization nowadays studded with priests is, interestingly, the Workers' Cooperative of Mondragon in the Basque country, which interestingly too was founded by the Catholic Church, rather than by any socialist radical, as you might have imagined. For the Church throughout, in the 19th and 20th century, has criticized both the national state and soulless capitalism, which it, much as in the Middle Ages, still condemned as a briefer usury. Very reluctantly, and under much protest and really by lack of an alternative, the Catholic Church has gradually resigned to a position where it at best can be moral lodestar of government, but where it does not constitute government, and cannot really materially influence governments either. And this separation of church and state was indeed critical, since the central axiom of the state is sovereignty, that is, that the state is the supreme and only lawgiver in the land, and cannot condone a second free-wielding authority, and certainly not one fostered on a foreign country, the Vatican, in its own land, which is under its own law. Now, there was of course a great deal of variation here. The paragon of harmonious relationships between church and state, the union between crown and altar, was probably the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that indeed perceived itself as upholder and defender of Catholic orthodoxy all over Europe. And as the Austrian state had abolished attempts of Emperor Joseph II in the 1790s to establish a separate hierarchy, the Catholic Church throughout supported the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. The one great promoter of separation between church and state in the 19th century became, on the one hand, France, where the non-partiality of the state in matters of religion, called laïcité in French, became a central principle of the state from roughly the reign of Napoleon III on, as the Catholic Church throughout supported the Bourbons. And on the other hand, and more or less involuntarily, it was the new country of Italy. As the main stumbling block to the unification of Italy was the existence of a papal state. A unified Italy without Rome was hardly imaginable, and Roma o morte became the great rallying cry of the nationalist. So that the Italian Republic officially declared Rome to be its capital, and the country, in the absence of Rome, was provisionally ruled from Florence. Italy then seized the occasion of the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to send the army into Rome. And this seizure of their territory, Pope Pius IX and his successors for the next 53 years refused to recognize. Pius and successors proclaimed themselves prisoners of the Vatican, until the matter was finally arranged by the Accord of Lateran of 1929, that recognized the Vatican as an independent mini-state within Rome and within Italy. To repeat, this anti-Catholic stance of the Italian state was more or less despite itself, for Italy obviously always remained a staunchly Catholic country. And one of the paradoxes of the period was that this was also the most Italian period of the papacy. Popes had more or less automatically to be Italian, and the College of Cardinals was completely dominated by Italian cardinals as well. So that the papacy at once abhorred Italy and constantly intervened in every minor issue of politics, for the whole institution remained parochially Italian indeed, and the official newspaper of the Vatican, the Osservatore Romano, thus editorialized on virtually any minor topic discussed in the Italian parliament. Seen in that perspective, the rise of nationalism as a secularized religion is primarily due to the withering of close ties between the church and the state, where the problem basically is that while in Europe this resulted from internal processes, beyond Europe this was by and large imposed by colonialism. Yet to refer to the US South, this was surely not the only process at work in nationalism. Whether it be the rise of such dominant, state-prescribed forms of nationalism as the American Dream or the United Kingdom's patriotism, or in the form of such more subdued, or to use a pretentious word, subaltern forms of nationalism as Southern nationalism in the USA or Scottish and Welsh nationalism in the United Kingdom. For in all three cases, there was also a strong undercurrent protest against the marginalization of those three in the national and indeed the world economy. Southern nationalism was probably at its strongest from roughly 1870 to 1940, as the South became the poorhouse of the United States, while Scottish nationalism had been very subdued, almost inaudible, merely a nice nostalgic form of folklore, when Scotland became an industrial powerhouse in the mid-19th century. Yet it began to revive as Scottish mining and Glasgow shipbuilding collapsed in the 1970s. Subaltern nationalism is very commonly an answer to economic and political forces that relegate a region to economic insignificance, as for example in the case of Flemish nationalism too, that emerged as Flanders in the 19th century became a rural backwater to industrialized Wallonia, so that Flemish speakers could feel they were given a raw deal in that whole new state of Belgium. That was a kingdom that had French as its official language, so that protest against that economic marginalization of Flanders within Belgium emerged around the language issue, in which Flemish was to be recognized as second language of Belgium. And after that was conceded in the 1870s, the Flaminganten wanted far-reaching decentralization of Belgium. Yet, I should immediately hasten to add, there are cases of the opposite as well. The government of Vienna had to take demands of Hungarian separatists very seriously, as Hungary was the breadbasket of Austria-Hungary. It could more or less ignore very similar demands for autonomy or national independence coming from, say, Ukrainian speakers in impoverished regions such as Carpathian Ruthenia or of Romanian speakers in the Bukovina. The problem for the Habsburg Empire was that any concession to one national group in turn elicited or ignited new nationalisms. The primeval nationalisms in the Habsburg Empire were the Italian ones, Veneto and Milan, that saw themselves as part of an Italian community rather than Austria they had been arbitrarily assigned to, and there was the nationalism of the Hungarians, which indeed goes back to the 17th century, as the Habsburg rulers might have been absolute rulers in Austria, but were dependent on a diet in Hungary. That diet was, however, abolished in 1815 and reconvened in 1848 as the Austro-Hungarian Empire was shaken by unrest in Milan and Vienna. The diet posed a series of 12 demands to Emperor Franz Joseph, which were rejected by the emperor, and that caused the diet on the Prime Minister Kossuth to proclaim Hungary to an independent state. This movement was subdued by an intervention of the Russian army, the Gendarme of Europe, for crown, church and landlords, as it was known at the time. However, 20 years later, after the Austrian army had been defeated by the Prussian one at Königgrätz, the emperor enacted far-reaching reforms, the so-called Compromise, in which Hungary and Austria became a personal union, of which the emperor retained the right to veto decisions of the Hungarian Diet and was to be the supreme warlord, but in which Austria and Hungary were both to have separate elected parliaments. Yet Hungary then in turn started to follow a policy of Magyarization, in which any political or social movements which challenged the hegemonic position of the Magyar ruling classes were henceforth liable to be repressed or charged with treason or incitement of national hatred, and so on, and in which education and administration was to be exclusively in Hungarian, not the easiest of languages, to say the least. Whereas 71% of the population of the Kingdom of Hungary was not Hungarian speaking. So the government had first whetted the appetite of Slovak or Romanian speakers, that were they to protest long and hard enough, they might be allotted regional autonomy, and then went out of its way to repress the very same urges as the Hungarian ones. Next to those economic factors, there were three other factors at work. Increased mobility and education as internal factors, and two external ones, great power politics and emigration. As to great power politics, to put it bluntly, all states in the Balkans, emerging out of the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, owe their existence to Russia, that partly wanted to finish off its old Ottoman rival, yet also experienced a sincere drive to liberate its orthodox co-religionaries from Muslim oppression, so-called Pan-Slavism. For the Ottoman Empire, indeed, often punished separatist movements in the Balkan in the most draconic way, with mass executions, such as, for example, during the great cause célèbre of the late 19th century, the attempted uprising in Bulgaria in 1877, which the Ottomans suppressed with scores of executions, at least 18,000 people, and that was widely publicized at the time as the Bulgaria Horrors. Russia had to defend its co-religionaries against such cruelties, St. Petersburg pleaded. Thus, Greek independence owed everything to Russian intervention during the naval battle of Navarino, and the Ottoman Sultan was only brought to concede to Greek independence under severe Russian pressure. The independent states of Romania and Bulgaria owe their very existence to the Russo-Turkish War of 1877, as Russia declared war on the Ottoman Empire to retaliate for the horrors, while Serbia, that had been an autonomous province of the Ottoman Empire so far, was recognized as an independent state after that war. In contrast, separatist movements in Western Europe could seldom count on great power support, which is why states in Western Europe appear as more permanently fixed. Thus, during the First Carlist War in Spain, mainly an uprising of the Basque country against a liberal government in Madrid in 1834, the British and French government agreed to financially and militarily support the central government, that was after 2 years of bitter open warfare and the further aid of guerrilla finally able to quell the uprising in streams of blood. Yet some British observers argued at the time that if the American colonies or the Greeks had a claim to become independent states, then the Basques surely had too, as they shared a long historical heritage, a very distinct language, and a very distinct culture. The Basque country had any claim to become a nation-state. Again, nationalism was also linked to immigration. Irish nationalism, and probably Basque nationalism as well, as the Basques migrated in masses after the Carlist Wars to South America and to Cuba, could not have subsisted without constant moral, but above all financial and military support to the national cause from overseas. The USA for the Irish and South America for the Basques. Irish radical nationalist movement, the Fenian Brotherhood, had close ties with the radical Irish Republican Brotherhood and was founded in New York in 1854. It supplied the Irish Republican Brotherhood with arms and bombs to start a terrorist campaign, as we would now say, of bomb attacks in England in the 1880s. To turn to internal causes, increased mobility was linked to two things, the railroad and mass migration to the big cities. And this brought isolated villagers, whose horizon had so far extended not much beyond their patrie, or their small parish, for the first time in contact with the rest of the country. Such contacts would commonly mark them off as hillbillies, in contrast to the sophisticated culture of the elites in the big cities. After all, it is difficult to see yourself as a rural bumpkin if you have only met hillbillies all your life. Of course, we are speaking here of the pre-TV and radio period. Important men from the villages, the village priest or the village teacher, were either by regularly going there or by way of printed matter they received from the big cities, henceforth in constant contact with sophisticated people in the city, and they developed a kind of inferiority complex relative to them. One reaction was for such people to try to merge into or to blend into the dominant culture of the cities, or, when they had a different language, try to become more proficient in the language than native speakers. Perhaps the classic description of the dilemma provincial intellectuals experienced is James Joyce's portrait of the artist as a young man, where the protagonist tries to reject his own stifling provincial milieu of Dublin, yet in London would forever remain an Irishman. One merely needs to glance at the last names in the phone directory of Vienna to note that many have indeed succeeded in merging into the dominant culture. Much of its population still clearly consists of grand and grandchildren of assimilated Magyars, Czechs or Poles. Whereas, if you take a look at the directory of Berlin as well, much of the population there is of assimilated Polish descent, and Petersburg was full of assimilated Finns. Even a few Irish have succeeded in that. However, assimilation was a slow and painful process and strategy, in which only a few succeeded, so that the more common reaction to increased mobility was a search for one's roots. Those villagers deigned by those urban slicks. Indeed, the most common group from which the nationalist in Eastern Europe stemmed were the village teachers, who were likely to remain second-rate teachers and be rewarded accordingly if they had to teach in a foreign tongue, Russian, Hungarian or German. Their common reaction in turn was then to try to raise the status of the villagers and prove they had as worthy a historical pedigree as all those city slickers. So they started to collect historic folk tales, folkloristic uses and songs that all were to prove they had as ancient and as venerable a culture as those Austrians, those Russians or those Germans in Vienna, St. Petersburg, Berlin or the Magyars in Budapest. A famous example is Finland's national epic, the Kalevala, compiled by village doctor Elias Lönnrot from various stories circulating in rural Finland and a part of Russia in the 1830s, and that became the cornerstone to a new literature in Finnish. So far a collection of rural dialects, while the lettered elite used Swedish. The Kalevala, after all, proved that those Finns, so far deemed mere lowly peasants, had as venerable, nay, a more ancient tradition as all those city slickers of Petersburg. The next step was then commonly to establish a national academy of learning, which was again commonly to compile a dictionary of the national language. That national language was to be carefully pruned of foreign words, and words were selected for the national vocabulary that lacked preferably any cognates in what were henceforth deemed foreign languages of the near abroad, or words were selected that came closest to the classic national tongue, as in the case of New Greek, that in the 19th century fell apart in the official language, the Katharenoussa, drawn up by the National Academy of Greece, and containing as much archaic and arcane words as possible, used by and carefully guarded by the state, and the Motic or Popular Greek, full of all kinds of impure loan words which state officials shouldn't to use. So that by the late 19th century, much of the Greek population could not understand the language used by their own government. Then commonly followed the first history of the nation, pointing to its glorious origins in the remote past, as with Skanderbeg's revolt. Next would follow the construction of a national art, in which the various national artists would go to the villages to study the traditional ways of art and building used by the common people. It was the great age of the erection of open-air museums of popular architecture throughout Europe. Again, they might collect music that was to inspire such national composers as Jan Sibelius for Finland, Edvard Grieg for Norway, or Antonín Dvořák for the Czechs. And then once, to put it very simply, such a national pedigree to the remotest past was established, demands for autonomy or statehood would soon follow, as activists cultivating that new national high culture began to mobilize a mass constituency behind their demands for political and cultural autonomy, though by no means always for statehood. So second, there was education. For as education in Europe gradually passed from being mainly a responsibility of the church towards becoming one of the state, and as primary education steadily expanded, the problem in multilingual areas became in what language it was to be done. Was it to be done in the national or in the imperial language? German or Hungarian in Austria-Hungary, Russian in the Russian Empire, or French in Belgium? Or was it rather to be done in, say, Finnish, Slovenian, Ruthenian, Ukrainian, or Flemish? Thus the language in which education was to be done became a perpetual bone of content in Belgium, the Habsburg Empire, and in such border regions of the Russian Empire as Estonia, Lithuania, or Latvia, where next to the majority speaking the native language, there were substantial Russian and Polish-speaking minorities as well. And education became the main issue round which separatist movements could rally. However, I have so far followed the recent academic consensus that argues, as I said before, that nations and nationalism are essentially 19th century constructs, and there is surely a lot of truth to that. Yet, making a nation cannot simply be learned from a textbook. As refugee Czech sociologist Ernest Kellner put it, nations need to have navels. They need some link to a historic past. They need a common feeling of belonging to a group and to a land. All this was certainly reformulated in the 19th century, but did not entirely emerge out of nothing. And indeed, it had often been suppressed by states or by elites in the early modern period, just as the nationalist argued, and indeed was still repressed by such 19th century empires as the Habsburgs, the Romanovs, and not in the least by the British Empire in Ireland. Thus, that Ireland has a claim to a separate identity going back to the 6th century is no mere claim and no mere tradition the Irish merely invented in the 19th century. So too, the uprising against Habsburg rule in 1618 in Bohemia, that was the signal of the 30 Years' War, had clear Czech nationalist elements to it, as indeed the Hussite uprising of the 15th century already had. It would go much too far to claim that Czech nationalism was invented or suddenly emerged only in the 19th century, as Kellner argued, an interesting case of Czech self-hatred. Again, Greek nationalism can be traced back all the way to the Byzantine Empire, and Serbian nationalism to the 13th century Kingdom of Serbia. Now, partly this may be because scholars guided by the two main ideologies of the 19th and 20th century, social democracy and liberalism, feel both uneasy with nationalism, as ties between people are perceived in either ideologies as primarily economic in nature, and other attachments as springing from those economic ties. Yet national belonging clearly does not. However, I feel there are also two hidden agendas behind the tendency of much of the modern literature to denigrate in particular nationalisms in small countries or of minorities by terming it a completely 19th century invention. First, the feeling that such nationalisms are an impediment to the development of a supposed patriotism for the European Union, a patriotism that alone might forestall future conflicts in Europe. Second, it is very easy for well-paid tenured academics who can apply for a job anywhere in the world to sing the praise of a cosmopolitanism that is now to replace narrow-minded nationalism. Yet this is not an option for most working-class people, who are financially, socially, and indeed emotionally still tied to a narrow cultural and linguist community and are rarely in touch with people beyond it. Even on holidays, they commonly stick to their own people. To them, their horizon is first their local community and then at best my country. Yet their horizon extends little beyond it. Nor should we assume the internet has changed very much in that respect. 2 years ago, Penthouse magazine, obviously not reading I would recommend to students, ran an inquiry what were the most frequently typed search terms men typed in on erotic websites, arranged by country. For Americans, the most frequently used term, as most of these websites are American, so you would have had hundreds of thousands of hits, was the slang term MILF, which I cannot translate for non-Americans for decency or podcast sake. But as to all other countries, Bolivian men typed in Bolivian ladies. French men typed in French ladies. Brazilian men typed in Brazilian ladies. And so on and on. An exception were the Japanese, who more embracingly typed Asian ladies. And the Russian men, an interesting detail, typed Russian or Ukrainian ladies. Thus, even in their most intimate moments, peeping at erotic movies in the privacy of their own home, late at night, and using a globalized medium, all the talk about cosmopolitanism and globalism notwithstanding, people still cannot shake the nation off. I shall return to that. But let us now first turn to Mazzini's other great question of the day, the worker man's issues.